Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Jobs. Any economist you talk to will say the economy can't really come back without them. Today, the White House took credit for saving or creating a whole bunch of them. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. 1,600 universities and colleges teach and manage 10 million students with software from SunGard Higher Education. More information at sunguard.com. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 30th of October, and it is great to have you with us. As of the last time the Labor Department clued us in, the U.S. economy has lost about 8.5 million jobs since the recession officially started almost 2 years ago. Add in what you'd need to get us back to where we'd be if the recession had never happened, and it's 11 million jobs. Bear that in mind as the context for the announcement out of the White House today. The administration says its $787 billion stimulus program has created or saved about 650,000 jobs so far. 640,329, if you want the actual number. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to check the White House's math.
Less than half the stimulus money has been spent so far. Today, Vice President Joe Biden said that spending has created jobs in construction and kept teachers from being laid off.
There's a strong and mounting evidence that the Recovery Act is putting people back to work.
The White House says it figured out how many people are back to work by asking businesses that received stimulus money how many jobs they created. State and local governments used stimulus money to avoid laying off government workers and teachers. Those were the jobs that were saved.
No one knows how to measure jobs saved. Do you know if your job has been saved? No one else does.
Alan Meltzer is a professor of political economy at Carnegie Mellon University. He says don't believe the White House numbers.
Throw them in the wastebasket. They mislead you.
Mark Vittner doesn't think the White House is misleading us. Vittner is the senior economist at Wells Fargo. He says there's no way to know exactly how many jobs were created or saved by the stimulus. It's just too hard to measure. Take construction jobs. You'd think that would be a concrete number, but Vittner says some workers are counted more than once.
If someone is working in the rotating business and they happen to get three different projects, then that would probably show up as three different jobs.
Economist Gus Fauché of Moody'sEconomy.com says, forget about the numbers. Look at the big picture.
If we didn't have the stimulus, I think the economy likely would have contracted in the third quarter, which means the labor market would be even worse.
How much worse? It's hard to say. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The World Wide Web is about to start living up to its name. The Internet is truly going global with a big linguistic change in how website addresses are written. No longer will it be Latin letters only, as in .com. The group that manages those web addresses, ICANN for short, is going to allow Chinese characters or Arabic script or any other alphabet for that matter. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the translation.
Right now, you can watch Moscow's Channel 1 on the Internet, but to get there, you still have to type www.1tv.ru even if you're in Russia, with a keyboard that includes Cyrillic letters. But starting next month, domain names can be written in scripts other than the one the internet was invented in, English.
Web addresses will become available in, for example, fully Chinese or fully Arabic or any alphabet that you can think of.
That's Tina Dam with ICANN, which oversees domain names. She says thousands of companies and organizations, from sports leagues to sportswear brands, might need to come up with new URLs.
If you look at India, for example, they have 22 different languages, and they're spread over, I think, 13 different scripts.
For a company like Coke, that could mean having to register in each one of those scripts and having to scramble to get hold of its name in other countries as well before someone else does.
I'm sure there will be something akin to a land rush when they first start allowing people to do this.
Dan Ackerman of the technology website CNET.
Big companies already take great pains to make sure they have all their requisite trademarks registered as domain names. If they have to go and look at all that information again in non-Latin character sets, that's obviously a big job, but I suppose that's why they have armies of lawyers.
Tina Dam says ICANN is looking for ways to make sure the rollout isn't too chaotic or costly for companies looking to protect their good names in cyberspace. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The war over book prices between the big online retailers has taken a new turn. Amazon, Walmart.com, and Target.com, as you may have heard, are trying to outprice each other on the latest hits. A book that might cost you $25 in an actual bookstore will cost you right around $9 on those sites. Independent booksellers were none too happy about that, but Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports they have managed to put the megastores on the defensive.
If you can't beat them, join them. That's the MO for some independent booksellers. They've discovered they can get a better price at Amazon or Walmart than they can from their regular distributors. So they buy online and then just turn around and sell the books in their stores.
I go to Amazon when they're offering over 40% discount on an item.
Gillette Kempf runs Borealis Bookstore in Wadena, Minnesota. To combat what she and other booksellers are doing, Amazon, Target, and Walmart are putting limits on how many copies of a book can be bought. But publishing analyst Michael Norris at Simba Information says it's the big chains that are causing the problem in the first place.
Non-bookstore retailers can sell books at a loss, and they can sell books for less than the price they paid because they usually like to treat them as loss leaders.
Meaning they sell them at a loss, hoping customers will be drawn in to buy other things.
The problem is that they're carrying these books and they have no stake in the future of printed books.
Still, Gillette Kempf at the bookstore in Wadena isn't worried she'll be run out of business. She says no online algorithm can provide the kind of customer service that she does. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
That gigantic thud you heard today was Wall Street giving back everything it got yesterday, and then some, for good measure. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In the grand scheme of things, one quarter of good economic news might not mean much. Coming as it does now, though, after a year or more of the Great Recession, it means a whole lot. So that's why we're going to start our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond with the gross domestic product numbers from yesterday. Here to help us do that are business writer Heidi Moore, also John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
I have something that's been on my mind since the GDP number came out yesterday, and I want to run it by you guys. And Heidi, I guess I'll pick on you first today. So there was a lot of poo-pooing yesterday about this 3.5% growth number and how it was only really strong because of government spending, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but isn't that what the stimulus package was supposed to do, stimulate the economy and get a higher GDP?
Yes, but what's happened is, of course, we can visualize a world in which the government will not be propping up GDP, and then that's where you really have a problem. So basically, what this ends up being is a huge political issue, right? This Congress was born under an incredible lucky star. The recession ends just in time for the 2010 campaign to start. But people are much smarter about what's kind of underlying a lot of our economic indicators right now. And those GDP numbers are not convincing because we know it is based on 0% interest rates and government spending and all of these things that can't last forever or indeed even for the next few months.
John, your take on GDP yesterday?
Well, I have to say, thank God it worked a little bit. If we had done all of this spending, the cash for clunkers, the home buyer tax credit, and the stimulus program, and not gotten a boost in GDP, then it would have been really, really frightening.
Okay, all right. Well, that's settled now. Moving on to other things. The topic of regulation is big in Washington this week. Secretary Geithner was up on the Hill yesterday talking about it. There are new rules to break up these banks before they get too big to fail and all that stuff. Question to you, Heidi Moore, is had these rules been in place a year and a half ago, would it have stopped Lehman Brothers from going under?
No, not really. I mean, what we have now—
But wait, back up. No, not really. So why are we having them now?
That's exactly the question, right? I mean, if you take a look at where we were before Lehman fell and where we are now, we are in exactly the same place, which is that firms that have government favor will survive and those that don't won't. And the new rules don't change that, basically, because what they allow the government to do is to interfere with even healthy firms and say you're undercapitalized and then take them over. But, you know, you still have the problem that the government's deciding who lives or dies.
John, too big to fail now, too big to fail forever. What do you think?
I think the deeper problem is that we've never gotten to the place where we really need to be, which is a credible situation where the government can look at a large financial institution and say, your risks are your own, so that its creditors and its investors will try to exert some control over it. And there's nothing that convinces me in this bill that the government is regaining that credibility that we actually have a free market system when it comes to large, complex financial institutions.
This is distressing. So what are we supposed to do? Because as we have said many times before in this segment, the guys that were too big to fail a year and a half ago are now even bigger.
Actually, what this bill may well do is actually encourage further consolidation. So if you're a smaller bank, your best bet might be to, you know, jump in with, say, J.P. Morgan Chase.
So, Heidi, basically J.P. Morgan Chase and Jamie Dimon, the CEO, are going to be running the world.
Yes. In fact, if they weren't already, which some people might question, I think Jamie Dimon might call you to task for that.
Real quick before we go, you guys, Timothy Geithner, Secretary of the Treasury, largely derided when he first came into office as being timid and ineffectual. And yesterday up on Capitol Hill, almost literally jumping and screaming. John, what do you think of this?
I think this was a bit of political theater. Tim Geithner was playing the flat catcher to provide political cover for the congressmen who are supporting these reform bills. They don't want to be seen as the handmaidens of Wall Street. They're all very worried about what happens in 2010. And Tim Geithner has sort of said, you know what, I'm not up for re-election. It's okay if the public hates me. So I think he was playing a game with the congressmen up on Capitol Hill.
You don't think he just wants to be loved?
I don't think he wants to be loved. I think he's given up that hope.
John Carney from ClusterStock.com, business writer Heidi Moore. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
The Supreme Court has packed its docket with cases about American businesses this term. The justices have agreed to take a look at Jeffrey Skilling's conviction. He's the former CEO of Enron. The court could throw out landmark accounting reforms that were set up after Enron collapsed. And next week, the justices are set to hear a case about investor protections in the mutual fund industry. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in Jones v. Harris. The case could undermine laws that were meant to protect mutual fund investors from unreasonably high fees. More than 93 million Americans have mutual funds, and even after this financial crisis, it's a $10 trillion industry.
And every year, investment advisors bring home $100 billion in fees from those funds.
William Birdthistle is a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law, and he's convinced many mutual fund advisors are overcharging their clients.
There's something unusual about the mutual fund industry. As fees go up, performance goes down.
That's not how free markets are supposed to work. But Birdthistle says many investors are stuck in mutual funds that charge high fees because they have limited choices at work for their retirement accounts. Nonetheless, last year, a federal appeals court in Chicago weakened investor protections meant to put a lid on high fees.
We were surprised, frankly.
Paul Stevens is president of the Investment Company Institute and represents the mutual fund industry. He says the industry was happy with the status quo.
We were not surprised that the judge, Judge Easterbrook, would conclude that this is a highly competitive business. In fact, it is.
Judge Easterbrook is a conservative icon. He's one of the most widely cited judges on the bench and a pioneer in law and economics. During his career, he's helped make the courts much more responsive to business concerns. But what surprised many observers like Stevens was how far Judge Easterbrook went in this case. He set aside long-standing court precedents that were already pretty easy on the mutual fund industry. William Byrd Thistle says there have been more than 500 investor lawsuits accusing mutual fund advisors of price gouging.
Now, no plaintiff has ever won. In 25 years, no plaintiff has ever won.
But in writing for the court, Judge Easterbrook raised the bar, making it harder for investors to prevail.
So you're going from a standard in which no plaintiff has won to a standard in which no plaintiff could theoretically ever win.
Easterbrook wrote that courts should get involved setting fees only if mutual fund advisors actually lie about their charges. After all, if investors think fees are too high, they can invest somewhere else. But this decision only applies to mutual funds in the Midwest, so it created different rules for funds in different parts of the country. The industry's Paul Stevens also worries that if Easterbrook's opinion becomes the law of the land, it could create a backlash and Congress could intervene.
Many industries like to have some clarity about what the rules of the road are.
So in the industry's brief, Stevens is asking the Supreme Court to return to the old status quo. And many legal observers believe that's the likely outcome.
Do you lose sleep over this case?
No, not over that or much else, actually.
Maybe that's the best illustration of just how pro-business the federal courts have become. And with dozens of business cases on its docket this year, the U.S. Supreme Court's likely to signal just how far it will let Congress and the administration go regulating business affairs. And these rulings could be a harbinger of the kind of scrutiny future regulatory reforms could face. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Coming up, rolling with the punches on global warming.
It's not so much about protecting ourselves from climate change. It's really about being resilient to the risks that we face.
But first, let's do the numbers. All Hallows Eve. Eve was gory on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials plunged 249 points, 2.5%, closed at 9,712. The NASDAQ dropped 52 points, also 2.5%, ended the day at 2,045. The S&P 500 gave back 29 points, 2.8%, finished at 1,036. For this scary Halloween week, the Dow slashed away 2.6%. The NASDAQ dropped 5.1%. The S&P 500 lopped off 4%. All 30 Dow components were down today. American Express and insurance company The Travelers were both down more than 4%. 3M posted a 2.5% loss. Bond prices gained. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.389%. Just to be really specific, you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor. Online at finrafoundation.org. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Monday. The Commerce Department releases the construction spending report for September. The President's Economic Recovery Advisory Board meets at the White House. The meeting can be seen via webcast at whitehouse.gov/live. And happy birthday to the Dakotas. On November 2, 1889, North and South Dakota were admitted as the 39th and 40th states of the Union. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. 6 weeks from now, the news will be, if not all climate change all the time, at least a whole lot of climate change a whole lot of the time. The UN is planning a big global warming conference in Copenhagen in the middle of December. Hopes are fading for a comprehensive agreement coming out of that meeting. But even if we stopped using fossil fuels today, stopped putting carbon into the atmosphere, scientists say the damage done by global warming will continue for years. Today, sustainability reporters Sam Eaton and Sarah Gardner are here again to continue our series, The Climate Race, by explaining, Sam, how we're getting ready to live in a warmer world.
That's right, Kai. The word people are using is adaptation, basically taking steps to deal with the effects of climate change.
And scientists tell us this is important because CO2 in the atmosphere can hang around for 100 years or more. And they tell us we have about a third more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now than we did before the Industrial Revolution.
Right, and all those gases have the potential to continue warming the planet regardless of what happens in Congress or Copenhagen.
So we're still facing the probability of more heat waves, bigger storms, higher sea levels off of our coasts. And Sam, at least 10 states in this country are already working on plans to deal with those risks.
And so are some cities. Here's Rit Agarwal. He's in charge of long-term planning for New York City.
Climate change is real, and it's going to be increasingly real as we go through our future. But it's not something to panic about. It's something to face with a clear-eyed, hard-headed, thoughtful approach. And if we do it that way, we don't have to panic.
We'll get back to the city in a few minutes, but first let's go to the country. Farmers are on the front lines of climate change, and they can adapt to a warmer climate up to a point. Farmers can switch to planting crops that tolerate more heat, for example, and that might be necessary in the United States. Some new research is out that suggests global warming could seriously hurt corn production in the Midwest, for example. But farmers can also change the way they grow food. This is especially important in places like the Southwest, where climate change could mean water shortages. And Sam, one farmer I met in Southern California may be ahead of his time.
I'm Casey Howling, and the company that we operate here is Howling Nurseries Oxnard, Inc. in Camarillo.
Now, Howling is a greenhouse farmer. He's built two new high-tech greenhouses right across from a celery field here. They each cover 20 acres of land, growing hundreds of thousands of plants, and I got the grand tour.
Yeah, this is a long English cucumber. It grows much faster than a tomato. It takes 10 days from flower till pick. Try them.
I tried everything he grows, actually. Mini cukes, tomatoes on the vine, cocktail tomatoes.
Okay, but greenhouses have been around for a long time. How are they going to help farmers adapt to climate change?
Well, first thing is they use less water than field farming. There's less evaporation because you're inside, and there's no runoff. Any water the plants don't absorb is recycled and used to water the plants again. Howling even goes so far as to collect rainwater and condensation. He claims he uses a sixth of the water used in tomato fields. But here's an extra bonus, Sam. If the climate is changing, moving indoors gives you stability. Here's Howling again.
You can control humidities, you can control temperatures, you can control CO2, and you keep your pests out. So you can control your quality to a much higher degree.
By the way, Howling is also producing electricity and heat for his greenhouses with solar power. He's sort of a green pioneer in the greenhouse world.
It's kind of ironic that actual greenhouses would help us deal with the effects of greenhouse gases. But there has to be a catch here, right?
Well, you can't grow all our food in greenhouses. It's just not economical to grow crops like wheat and soybeans this way. These greenhouses that Howling built set him back $50 million, and he figures it'll take more than a decade to earn back his investment. I talked to Merle Jensen. He's a well-known expert in greenhouse farming. He says greenhouses like Howling's produce 20 times more crops per acre than traditional farming, but it's a more expensive way to grow food, and so the food is more expensive as well.
You know, that kind of investment, we're talking more than $1 million per acre. And what you saw at the facilities in California, they're probably the highest tech greenhouses today in the world, and time will prove whether that is economical in the future.
And, you know, this highlights one of the key challenges in adapting to climate change. If we wait until those high-tech greenhouses are really needed, the cost of building everything all at once would be enormous. New York City's Rit Agarwal, who we heard from earlier, is working on a plan to gradually phase in changes to the city's infrastructure, starting with facilities that are most at risk from climate change in the near term.
We do make small investments now that can avoid large costs later on. The way I would suggest we need to think about climate change adaptation, it's like insurance. You know, you protect yourself against a certain amount of risk. You accept a certain amount of risk because it would be too expensive to protect yourself against every possible risk.
And this is exactly what New York is doing. It's about to spend $30 million moving crucial equipment at a sewage treatment plant in Queens to higher ground. Vincent Sapienza with the city's Wastewater Treatment Bureau took me on a tour.
We're headed from ground level, which is just above sea level, down to the lower levels of the plant where there are the main sewage pumps.
Those pumps, each the size of a semi-truck, are about four stories below sea level, and so are the electric motors that run them.
And that's the concern, is that because we are so close to the ocean here, that within the next several years, there can be a storm that inundates these motors.
And what's important to note here is that this relatively small investment, $30 million, won't actually keep the plant from flooding. That would cost billions. But moving those motors above sea level will keep them dry. Even if the plant floods, the pumps keep running. Here's Rit Agarwal again.
It's not so much about protecting ourselves from climate change. It's really about being resilient.
So, Sam, I'm assuming there are examples like this all across the city. How are they deciding what to fix? I mean, budgets are tight these days.
They are, but the key here isn't to do all of these projects at the same time. It's to sort of institutionalize the idea of adaptation. That way, as the city performs regular upgrades to things like water treatment plants, the subway, its airports, those projects are done with climate change projections in mind.
But even that's going to add costs.
That's true. And you look at some of the long-term climate projections, and those costs only get bigger. New York, for example, may eventually have to build a giant seawall to protect it from rising sea levels, something that will probably run in the hundreds of billions of dollars. But to some, that cost is an opportunity.
We don't see it as an economy killer at all. We sort of see it as an economy maker. So.
That's Mark Fulton. He leads climate change investment research for Deutsche Bank. I met up with him in front of Penn Station, and you can hear the sounds of our carbon-fueled economy all around us. We came here to get a view of a giant carbon clock the bank recently installed here. It tracks the world's emissions of CO2 and other greenhouse gases in real time. And the fact that this was put here by a bank says something. Deutsche Bank is investing billions of dollars in technology to help fight and cope with global warming.
You know, we really take a very different view because we're investors. So we're looking at the other side of what people call a cost, which is an investment.
And this is why Deutsche Bank put the carbon clock up there in the first place. You look up at this clock and you can't help being a little spooked. I mean, it's going up about 800 tons a second. And what frustrates Fulton is that so few people seem to notice it. He says climate change will transform the global economy, and the money to do it is there. The only question is whether we control that transformation or it controls us.
Sam Eaton and Sarah Gardner from the Sustainability Desk with the latest installment of our series, The Climate Race. We've got the earlier stories on our website. It's marketplace.org. A correction now from yesterday's segment. We were talking about coal as a source of electric power. According to the Department of Energy, we get almost half of our electricity from coal. 45% is the actual number.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, one last thought about what letter shape the economy will most resemble as a recovery gets going. We spent some time yesterday talking about whether what we've got here is a W-shaped bounce back, but a big-time marketing guy over in the UK sees it a different way. Sir Martin Sorrell, the head of the giant ad agency WPP, picked up on a Reuters story that breaks it down like this. In the UK and Western Europe, the recovery will be L-shaped. The steep drop at the beginning of the downturn, followed by a long, flat period. The U.S. is going to be U-shaped, a slow turnaround. Asia and the developing economies will look more like a V. So I guess love means never having to say recession, hmm? That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow plummeted 249 points. That is 2.5%. The NASDAQ dropped 52 points, also 2.5%. The S&P 500 gave back 25 points to 0.3%. Our series, The Climate Race, was produced by Steve Gregory. Our theme music is composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Ure. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, it's a really simple definition of bankruptcy.
They owe more than they own. That's insolvency.
Also, how to get out of it. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.